Welcome to Women from United Nations Radio in New York. I'm Deanne Penn. Dr. Marlene Timmerman, who's head of the Department of Reproductive Health and Research at the World Health Organization in Geneva, joined the agency late last year because she believes it can play a very prominent role in servicing the unmet needs of many women in the area of reproductive health. In this interview with Beng Poblete Enriquez, Dr. Timmerman recalls an early experience in Kenya when a 15-year-old pregnant girl who was found on the streets died in her arms because of a ruptured uterus. But first, she outlines her priorities for the next 2 years.
Priority number one is the family planning area, because a lot of women, mainly in developing countries, they die in pregnancy or in childbirth, and family planning, contraceptives, are really a key intervention to lower the maternal mortality. If you have access to family planning, you can plan your families, you have less pregnancies, prevent unwanted pregnancies. The young populations in the world, we really also have to concentrate on them and to make sure that they live healthy and that they also have access to good family life education, sexual education, and access to family planning where needed.
You probably have some amazing stories to tell. Can you share with us one or two?
I'm an obstetrician gynecologist by training, and I went to Kenya in the mid-80s to conduct research in the field of HIV/AIDS. I worked as a lecturer at University of Nairobi, but based at the Pumwani Maternity Hospital, which is one of the busiest maternities in Africa, I think, with 80 to 100 deliveries a day in rather difficult conditions. And the first woman who died in my hands actually was at that place. And I will never forget, it was a young girl. She was just 15 years old. And she came into the maternity. She didn't move anymore. She was brought in. People found her in the street. So she was still alive, but the baby had died already, and she died like 2 hours later. We did everything we could to save her life, but in vain, because the uterus was ruptured after 3 days in labor. So I was so upset, because this girl should not have been pregnant. Being pregnant, she should have had access to health care. But she was just living on her own as the oldest girl of a family of six whose parents died of AIDS. And this dramatic experience, unfortunately, it was not the only one, because I have seen many women, many children dying. They die because of hemorrhage. They die because of blood pressure problems, of HIV, because of infections. All these things can be prevented.
Are there any changes, though?
There are changes. I mean, if you look at the number of women who die per year in pregnancy and in labor, some years ago we had over 500,000, and now we have reduced that to something like 250,000 women per year, but it's still too many.
The World Food Programme this week resumed its work in the Somali port city of Kismayo for the first time in 4 years. Kismayo had previously been a stronghold of Al-Shabaab militants who were expelled by Somali and African Union forces. Perhaps this is an example of the changes underway in Somalia, where for decades life has been about surviving war, famine, and violence, in the words of the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR. These conditions have also affected Somali women who give birth and raise their families regardless of what's going on in the country. A few weeks ago, Gududu Galinle, a displaced mother, gave birth to her fifth child, a daughter she called Fatun. While her other children were all born at home, Gududu gave birth to the little girl at the Galkayo Medical Center. That's because both their lives were at risk due to complications in her pregnancy.
The best way to deliver is at the hospital, because you get support if anything happens. I deliver at home because sometimes I'm just not ready, but it's always safer to go to the hospital.
The Galkayo Medical Center was established by Dr. Abdul Kadir Giyama more than 15 years ago. Initially, it was a private clinic specializing in motherhood care, but the center opened its doors to internally displaced families throughout Galkayo in 2005.
We have to take care of the patient during the pregnancy and let him have a good antenatal care, where you can actually identify the high-risk patient and monitor it closely during the pregnancy and during the labor and after the labor.
He says donor support, particularly from the Arab Emirates, has helped bring modern facilities such as labs, an X-ray machine, and even a mobile clinic to Galkayo Medical Center. But the donations also allow for help to be extended beyond the walls of the hospital. Saruru Robo Ishak, a self-taught midwife, recently attended a training session on safe delivery at the center.
The risk expectant women faced during delivery was very high, as we didn't have enough skills and materials. Before, we were just using a razor blade, but GMC trained us and gave us complete safe delivery kits, including plastic sheets and disinfectant soap.
Saruro also can count on the center's help in emergencies. Dr. Giyama, the founder of the Galkayo Medical Center, says all the support they've received has been vital. And no doubt, new mother Gududu agrees. She and baby Fatun are now safely back at home, proof that access to healthcare can save lives. 7 indigenous youth from across the world shared their experiences at the first international expert group meeting for indigenous young people held this week at UN headquarters in New York. That's where I met Andrea Landry from Canada, or Eagle Heart Woman, which is her traditional name in the language of the Anishinaabe people of North America. Even though she's pursuing a master's in communications and social justice at the University of Windsor in Canada, Andrea is committed to advocacy, including through Idle No More, a movement started by Indigenous Canadians to counter government actions that could have an impact on natural resources.
I'm here to represent the North American Indigenous youth, and the reason why it's integral for us to be here is to ensure that our voices are heard 100% and that we ensure that our recommendations are considered seriously and they are implemented through the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which Canada has endorsed. Most of the articles are severely neglected, but the ones that I'm focusing on was in accordance to languages and identity in Indigenous youth. Our Indigenous languages are severely associated with our identity. Yet, when you live in a city in an urban setting, our languages are pretty much non-existent. And that is a very big issue because as an Indigenous youth, you want your connection with culture, you want your connection with community.
Now, another part of the Declaration also deals with Indigenous rights to their own lands, to worship and things like that. And we know now in Canada, there's the movement that's recently started, Idle No More. And I understand you're also a part of that.
Mm-hmm. Right now, I started with local rallies and then I developed the national rally in Ottawa on January 11th, we had a total of almost 8,000 people who came out. And the way we designed the whole process was to dismiss the politics and to realize that ceremony always surpasses politics. And it was through that we realized that's where the real power of our people lays within this movement, is by starting with ceremony and practicing our ceremonies, our movement can only grow stronger. We did a round dance around Parliament. It was the biggest round dance I've ever seen, and it was just absolutely beautiful, and we're coming together in unity. But we also see this new transformation occurring where non-Indigenous counterparts are also coming in, and they're beginning to understand why we're having this fight and why we're fighting for our rights, and they're also speaking on behalf of us on our issues. And now you also see this international movement occurring. You see other Indigenous groups attaching with it and really supporting the movement as a whole. So it's transcended from a national movement to an international movement, which is really exciting to see.
When we started, you spoke about the difficulties of being Indigenous people in urban settlements.
So the reality is when an Indigenous young person moves to the city, they lose the connection with their culture. So when you're in the city, you kind of reprioritize. You realize, or you tend to think, that the important thing is to get a Western society education, to get a job, to get money, capitalism. But when you're living in your Indigenous community, you realize that the only way you truly are rich is through your culture and your traditions. So you get kind of lost between the traditional world and the Western world. You're walking in two worlds and you're trying to find balance. So I think that with this disconnect comes, you know, other escapes that Indigenous youth are trying to cling to, whether it's alcoholism or drug use or, you know, high suicide rates. I think a lot of Indigenous youth are becoming more aware, especially with the Idle No More movement, because they see ceremony within the movement. And when they're within those ceremonies and within the movement, they regain their power, which is integral to who we are as Indigenous people.
You've been listening to Women from United Nations Radio in New York. I'm Deanne Penn.